Welcome to Declaring Independence, a show dedicated to the idea that if two people are thinking exactly alike on everything, one of them probably isn't thinking at all. Here's your host, Ed Brayton.
Good evening and welcome to Declaring Independence on Public Reality Radio, WPRR, 1680 AM. I'm your host, Ed Brayton, and we have a very interesting show for you tonight. My first guest will be Ayaan Hirsi Ali, whose powerful story you may have heard. We have a fairly short interview with her that we did last week to present first. Then my second guest for most of the hour will be Dr. Ken Miller, who will be talking about evolution and intelligent design. But I want to jump right now into that first interview because there's so much that I want to cover with Dr. Miller later on. My first guest is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who has a remarkable life story. She was born in Somalia and raised in a fundamentalist Muslim family. She was a victim of the incredibly barbaric act of female circumcision at 5 years old. She escaped an arranged marriage to a much older man and made her way to the Netherlands, where she eventually became a member of parliament. After several years, it came out that she had lied in her application for asylum, which she fully admits to doing, but says it was necessary in order to get expedited consideration of her request, and she was thrown out of the political party she belonged to. She now lives in the United States, where she is an outspoken critic of radical Islam. This interview was done last week, and I want to add a disclaimer before we air it. There is a good deal of criticism in this interview from myself and from Hirsi Ali aimed at the left, and I want to make something very clear right up front. This is not a criticism of everyone on the left or of liberalism in general. I have long maintained that there are two distinct groups on the left, which I call the rationalist left and the postmodernist left, and there are some big disagreements between the two groups. The postmodernist left is where we tend to find moral and cultural relativism, and that is what Ali and I disagree with and are criticizing, not liberalism in general. I believe it is very, very important for the left to lead the way in making a coherent critique of radical Islam for several reasons. First, because radical Islam is the most anti-liberal ideology in the world today. Whether we're talking about women's rights, gay rights, or any other set of secular liberal values, radical Islam represents the antithesis of those values. Second, because if we allow the right to take the lead in making that critique, then it will inevitably be wrapped up with some other noxious concepts like Christian chauvinism, American exceptionalism, or just old-fashioned xenophobia and racism. We cannot allow people with those views to define opposition to the barbaric values found in radical Islam. It is very important that we make a distinction between moderate forms of Islam that have reconciled their religious views with the values of liberal democracy, and those reactionary forms of Islam that continue to practice hatred and violence in the name of a barbaric God. It is important that we reach out to moderate Muslims and build on our common acceptance of liberal values. But at the same time, we must offer up a powerful and coherent critique of radical Islam and an equally coherent defense of the values of freedom, tolerance, and equality that they oppose so firmly. With all that said, here is my interview with Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Ms. Ali, thank you very much for making a little time for us today.
I'm happy to, and I'm grateful that you have me on air.
My radio show deals frequently with issues of religious skepticism and the promotion of rationalism. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your experiences and how they relate to those issues. It has long concerned me that there is a faction of the American left that believes that it's wrong to criticize radical Islam and to assert the superiority of liberal democratic values. I know this is something that's concerned you as well and that you've written about. Give us your perspective on that split on the left between, for lack of better terms, the secular rational left and the sort of multiculturalist relativist left.
I find it ironic that the left of all groups would be tolerant of radical Islam and its pernicious manifestations and be extremely intolerant of the mildest, most friendly forms of Christianity and Judaism and so on. I was confronted with, or rather my skepticism is born out of being and brought up as a Muslim. And the thing that stung me as a practicing, praying, worshipping Muslim was the position that I, just because as I was a female, I was considered to be dumb, I was considered to be useless except to be a mother and a wife, I was considered to be subservient, and I was assumed to follow all of that, and there was absolutely no equality, and my skepticism of my own, the religion of my own parents, came out of that. And when I came to the West and I found the left-wing groups, I learned of their history as fighting for the underdog. And I was, I find it ironic, if the underdog is the working class, if the underdog is the slave, if the underdog is the male slave, it's all fine. But if it's the Muslim woman, then we ought to respect Islam. And it's just a logic that I can't get over.
I don't think that's true of the entire left, but I think there are some factions there that you've described accurately, and that fact has always disturbed me as well. You wrote a book called The Caged Virgin, An Emancipation Proclamation for Women in Islam. Give us your perspective based on your own experiences within the Islamic world and how the values held by many in that religion are stand in stark contrast to liberal notions of freedom and equality, particularly for women.
My experience starts with separating the space of men from the space of women. Men have the role of being the father, the breadwinner, the protector of the family, the maintainer. And women are the wives and the sisters, and, you know, they're supposed to obey and serve him. And that, I think, is something that in all religions, probably in all human arrangements, is recognized. But Islam takes it deeper and more. You know, Sharia law says my testimony is worth half of that of a man. That's crazy, because if I'm raped, my testimony is worth half of that of the rapist. I can be divorced at will. I inherit half of what my brother inherits. I can be, you know, forced into marriage as of the age of 9, as of the age of menstruation. These are all arrangements that you don't see in other religions and in other cultures. And so that was my first experience with it. I lived in Saudi Arabia, and I have seen what it is, how women look like when they're completely covered in black clothing, when they're forbidden from going outside the house, when they're denied education, all of that. And then I came to the Netherlands, and in a free, liberal country, in a secular country like the Netherlands, where almost everything is possible as long as you don't harm others, I found small communities of Muslims where women lived as if they were under the reign of the Taliban. And so that's a different perspective of my experience. I was now a free woman in Holland as of 1992, and witnessing how women, simply because they were labeled Muslim, were condemned to a position where they were oppressed completely, where they were slaves, their rights were taken away in a free country. And the strangest thing was that the free peoples were either ignoring this or justifying it in the name of culture and religion.
I've been arguing for a long time that it's important that the left take the lead in criticizing radical Islam in a manner at least close to what Christopher Hitchens has done in this country. Now, I don't happen to agree with him in the war in Iraq, but I strongly agree with him that the left needs to be at the forefront of making a coherent critique of reactionary Islam. Because if we allow the right to do so, then that criticism will often be accompanied by a sort of Christian chauvinism or American exceptionalism. And I saw a statement from you where you told an interviewer that we essentially faced a choice between Islamic fascism and right-wing fascism, because if as liberals we fail to respond to this, it will inevitably lead to the right-wing fascists responding to it in a far worse way. Explain that position.
It is the same position that Christopher Hitchens takes, and I think Hitchens is brave, he's caring, he's committed, and he's consistent. He is one of the first people within the left and the most determined voices within the left who says he's not going to go out there saying Christian fundamentalism is bad if he cannot say the same of Islamic fundamentalism, which, by the way, today in the 21st century is more relevant.
Yeah, and I would strongly agree with that. I think that modern Christianity and modern Islam are not equally dangerous. Christianity, while it still includes much that I object to, has been humanized by contact with Enlightenment principles over the last few centuries. And there are voices in Islam, people like Muqtadar Khan, who are calling for the same sort of thing within Islam, a reconciliation between those ancient traditions, but being informed by modern ideas of liberty and equality and justice. How likely do you think it is that Islam can achieve that kind of mixture the way Christianity has, at least to some extent?
Well, reconciliation, in my view, is achievable only and only if Muslims give up following the example of the Prophet Muhammad in every way, if they question him and review his teachings and his morals, so that everything that Muhammad said that is inconsistent with democracy, with freedom, with respecting the liberty of individuals, the sexuality of both men and women, only then will there be any kind of reconciliation. As a liberal, I'm not prepared to compromise my rights and freedoms, and I'm not prepared to compromise the rights and freedoms of my fellow human beings. And as long as that is the case, and the Muslims do not want to, compromise what Muhammad told them, then we're going to be in a perpetual state of conflict. How likely is that? It depends on who gives up first, and I'm not prepared to compromise life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
There certainly are some groups within Islam that are sort of making an effort to do that. And do you think that it's the United States that should be reaching out to those groups who have accepted the values of liberal democracy and build bridges to them and ally with them against the radicals, or do you think that's sort of futile?
Absolutely. I think we should reach out to any individual within Islam and outside of Islam who is seriously prepared to compromise the teachings of jihad, of misogyny, of separating the world into infidels and Muslims, calling Jews pigs and Christians monkeys. If they want to come, anybody within the Muslim world who wants to compromise that, leave that behind, should be applauded and should be encouraged and helped and included into everything that freedom has to offer.
I really appreciate your call for not compromising on this. And one of the things that I've enjoyed reading you in the past is that you've spoken out very passionately on the subject that I care a great deal about, which is free speech, the right to offend.
Yes.
In 2006, speaking about the Danish caricatures of Muhammad and the spasm of violence that took place following their publishing, you said, and I'm going to quote you here directly, "I do not seek to offend religious sentiment, but I will not submit to tyranny. Demanding that people who do not accept Muhammad's teachings should refrain from drawing him is not a request for respect, but a demand for submission."
Yes.
Now, I publish those caricatures on my blog, and I encourage others to do the same. Tell us why you think it's so important to stand up in the face of those threats of violence and refuse to submit to them.
If we don't stand up to those threats, let me put it differently. If we stand up to those threats, we may win. If we do not, then we lose, and tyranny overtakes us all. And the same thing has happened in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Pakistan, in Egypt, anywhere where the principles of Islam have become the principles of political and social rule, that tyranny has manifested itself. And the first people, the first group to suffer are women. And I think that if you say, we are going to accommodate them for the sake of a temporary peace now, then either we or our children will have to deal with a society that resembles very much like the society in Iran.
Let me get your sense. You don't, as I understand it, you are back living in Denmark now?
No, I live in the United States.
Oh, you are back in the United States now. Okay, yeah. I was out of date on that. Obviously, you pay attention to goings-on in our political system. Give us your assessment of our new president, Barack Obama, and how you think he's going to deal with these issues.
Well, like everyone else, I'm very enthusiastic about his election. And I just came from Europe 2 days ago and saw how, I've never seen Europeans so positive about America as after the election and inauguration of Barack Obama. And I hope, and I listened to his victory speech, his inauguration speech, and I think It's a beautiful speech. It is a vision, and the world is looking out to see what he does. America is looking out to see what he does. But Barack Obama is the president of the United States, the leader of the free world, and he must, I find, cash in on all this support that's coming in from Europe and elsewhere to defend the principles of freedom.
Yeah, that certainly is my hope as well. I'm glad to hear that you're back in the United States, and glad to hear that you're here speaking out. I can't wait to see you speak tomorrow morning. Let me ask you one more question. At one point, you were working on a book, and it may be out. I may have simply missed it, about the Prophet Muhammad waking up in the New York Public Library and being confronted by, among others, John Stuart Mill, who is, you had said, was one of your favorite liberal thinkers. He is one of my favorite thinkers of all time as well. Is that a book that you ever finished?
I'm not finished. I'm still working on it.
Okay.
It is scheduled to be published in 2010.
And that was called Shortcuts to the Enlightenment?
Shortcuts to Enlightenment,
okay.
Yes. It's a dialogue. It's a dialogue between Muhammad and three of my favorite thinkers. One is John Stuart Mill, and Muhammad and Mill will talk about women and the position of women in society. Karl Popper and Muhammad will talk about tribalism versus the open society. Muhammad will defend the tribal order, and Karl Popper will defend the open society. And the third thinker is called Friedrich Hayek. And he will defend individualism, and where Muhammad will defend collectivism. And I hope that the readers find it interesting and join in the debate. And I think, and I hope it leads to a discussion among Muslims and within the Muslim world.
Yeah, certainly, you know, those thinkers are, you know, a big part of our Western heritage, and I think elucidated a very, very clear philosophy of valuing the rights of the individual, and that I think is really the key to present that as an alternative to the vision of radical Islam. Ms. Ali, thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy, and I appreciate you taking time to be on our show.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bazin.
All right. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We are going to skip the Wingnut of the Week for this week because I want to get right to my next guest. It is a real honor and a pleasure for me to introduce Ken Miller, who's going to be with us for the rest of the hour. I've been involved in the evolution creationism battle for about 20 years, and I can't think of anyone who has done more to both protect and improve science education in this country than Ken Miller. Dr. Miller is a professor of cell biology at Brown University. He's the author of several biology textbooks for all age levels, and in my opinion, the most eloquent defender and advocate that evolution has in this country. Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure.
You have a new book out called Only a Theory, Evolution and the Battle for America's Soul. And it's a book that I got to read during my recent vacation. And before we get into the substance of the book, I want to bust your chops for a minute over something you said in the preface. Are you ready for that?
Sure, ready to go. Fire away.
In the preface to the book, you talk about your work as an expert witness in the Dover trial, which I was involved in, you know, well behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that you said in there that you remain in awe of the legal talents of Vic Walchek, Eric Rothschild, and Steve Harvey, and rightfully so. They did an absolutely brilliant job in the case. And then you say you were honored to join with your fellow expert witnesses, Barbara Forrest, Jack Haught, Kevin Padian, and Brian Alters in that trial, leaving out my good friend and the co-founder of Michigan Citizens for Science, Robert Pennock. Where's the love for Rob?
That was an incredibly careless omission. And the book is coming out in one more printing in hardcover, and it's also coming out in about 2 months in paperback. And trust me, Rob will be there in his rightful place, and I don't have any idea how his name slipped my mind. He did absolutely wonderful work in the trial.
Well, fair enough, and he's done great work on this issue for a long time, as have you. In all seriousness now, I want to spend a fair amount of time talking particularly about the views of Michael Behe, who's one of the most prominent advocates of intelligent design in this country. And we're getting a little technical, and I'm going to rely on the fact that you do such a terrific job of explaining these technical issues in a way that the layman can understand.
As we said when we got together before the trial to plot strategy, if you can explain it to a lawyer, you can explain it to anyone. Right. So I'll give it a shot.
Behe is author of two books advocating the idea of irreducible complexity. Give my listeners a basic overview of what that phrase means as used by Dr. Behe.
Well, let's start out with something that everybody agrees on, and that is that the living cell is filled with what you might call complicated multi-part protein machines. There's no question about that. So, for example, one of the most complicated of these is a little machine that cells have by the thousands called the ribosome. And the ribosome is like a little factory that helps to manufacture proteins. And it itself, depends on the species, it itself is made of anywhere from 80 to 100 proteins and several very critical pieces of RNA. There are also biochemical machines that do things like clot our bloodstream. There are biochemical motors, literally motor proteins, that produce movement. And one of the most famous of these, and Dr. Behe's favorite for sure, is a cool little rotary engine that whips around the flagella of bacteria, and we usually just call it the bacterial flagellum. And all of these are composed of multiple parts. The bacterial flagellum, depending upon species, anywhere between 30 and 40 different proteins. So here's the argument. Behe says that each of these machines is irreducibly complex. Now think about that. It means you can't reduce its complexity. And here's what he means by that. His idea is that the individual parts of these machines simply have no uses on their own. They're only workable when all the parts are put together. It's sort of like, you know, a very complicated machine with a lot of gears. And if you leave even one gear out, the darn thing doesn't work. So you have to put in the flagellum, part number 28, nothing happens. Part number 29, nothing happens. All of a sudden, you put in part number 30, and whoosh, the thing whirls to life. Now, what Dr. Behe says is, first of all, that's the way things are. And secondly, since that's true, none of these complicated, irreducibly complex systems could have been produced by evolution. And the reason they couldn't have been produced by evolution, according to him, is because evolution can only fashion a few proteins at a time. And I would say, yeah, that's pretty much true. And since none of these proteins has any function, according to him, until the entire machine is assembled, it's not like a cell can say, well, I'm going to evolve the first 20 parts of this 30-part machine, knowing that 10 million years from now, I'll get part number 21 and then part number 22, and finally something will happen. Evolution doesn't have foresight. That's certainly true. So the existence of these irreducibly complex systems, by Behe's argument, is proof that they weren't made by evolution. Now, if they weren't made by evolution, how'd they get there? Now, he actually has no positive evidence for that, and he admits that, but he takes that as an argument for intelligent design. He says if they didn't evolve, then they must have been put there by some sort of intelligent power that was able to assemble all of these parts, put them all together, and get them working. So that's the essence of this argument from irreducible complexity. And at first glance, it's a pretty strong argument. It sounds terrific.
Yeah, I think to the layman it sounds very compelling. And I want to go through some of the aspects of his testimony during the Dover trial, because I think this is going to be very revealing for what it says about the ID movement and about the validity of his arguments.
Sure.
One of the things that jumped out at me in the transcript of his testimony was that he didn't appear particularly interested in testing those ideas himself. And I'm going to read just a bit of this testimony. He was asked whether his concept of irreducible complexity were testable. He said, yes, they were. And then Eric Rothschild asked him, but you don't do those tests. And here's his answer. Well, I think someone who thought an idea was incorrect, such as intelligent design, would be motivated to try to falsify that. And certainly there have been several people who have tried to do exactly that. And I myself would prefer to spend time in what I would consider to be more fruitful endeavors. Isn't this the exact opposite of the approach a real scientist would take? If you'd come up with what you considered to be a revolutionary idea, an idea so powerful that it would overthrow one of the most well-accepted ideas in all of science, wouldn't you want to do all the research you can on it and do those tests yourself?
Of course, of course. And, you know, one of the most important things that any scientist can do is to generate a testable idea. Even if ideas are wrong, if they're testable and you learn something as a result of the test, they still move science forward. And it's almost an axiom. It certainly is something that my research advisor told me when I was working for my PhD, and that is if you come up with a provocative and testable idea, test it yourself before anybody else gets a chance, because then proving yourself wrong, there's no dishonor. And that was the key thing. But here's the thing. It's not just that Dr. Behe hasn't tested his idea. Because, you know, he may say, look, I'm a theoretician. I'm going to spin out provocative ideas so that other people can test them. But the important thing here is the entire intelligent design movement is simply devoid of any move towards experimental testing. They just don't do that. But what they're involved in is the construction of arguments against evolution and then public relations and political lobbying. And that tells you right away that the main goal that they have isn't scientific, it's political, it's cultural, and in fact, it's even religious.
Yeah, and this is something that's going to be a thread through this whole conversation, I'm sure. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the incuriosity in this regard is caused by the fact that the few times they have attempted to do any actual scientific research on this, it's ended up backfiring on them. And I want to look in some detail at the paper that Dr. Behe wrote with David Snoek in the journal Protein Science in 2004, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with.
Yep.
On the witness stand, Behe said that this paper argued for the irreducible complexity of things such as complex protein binding sites. Give us a brief non-technical explanation of what a protein binding site is and what this paper purported to show about it.
Well, proteins are these wonderful, flexible molecules that can do all sorts of things chemically and that really make life possible. And the way in which you build a protein is you snap together a series of subunits. These subunits are called amino acids. There are about 20 of them found in living cells. So you can snap them together in all sorts of configurations. But unlike, you know, little pop beads that you might snap together, as you do this with proteins, they fold. And they fold into, many cases, very intricate three-dimensional structures. Now, a protein by itself can often carry out chemical reactions and so forth. But what proteins in the cell more often than not do is they attach to other proteins. So they form larger structures that can do more complicated things biochemically and can even do things like generate motion, pump molecules in and out of the cell, and so forth. So the ability to bind to anything, certainly to another protein, is absolutely essential. And what the Snoek's and Behe paper was simply a computer simulation. Wasn't any experiments. And what they did in the computer simulation is they said, well, let's suppose that we have a very minimal binding site, a binding site, let's say, consisting of maybe just two of these amino acids. Now, it turns out that genetically, in the language of DNA, it takes three different letters in the DNA code to specify an amino acid. So to have a binding site that has just two amino acids, you have to get six letters of that code right. Well, what they argued is that the odds against doing this are astronomical, and they basically ran some calculations, and they said that to produce a single binding site would take something on the order of 10 to the 8th power cells, and 10 to the 8th power is 100 million, about 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 7 years, which is a million or 10 million years, and therefore it would be virtually impossible. And therefore, the binding sites we do see in living cells, and there are lots and lots of them, couldn't have evolved, it takes too long, but must, in fact, have been produced by a designer. So that's the argument in the paper. But as you may know, and as you might be going to next, Eric Rothschild, our attorney, opened that paper and then started to ask Dr. Behe a few questions.
Yes, and that's exactly where I'm going with this, because in fact, this paper, I think, and I think, you know, most educated people think, actually argues against irreducible complexity.
Oh, I think it does, too.
What it concluded was that particular complex binding site, according to their simulation, could evolve with a population of 1 billion organisms, and we're basically talking bacteria here,
right,
approximately. It was a computer simulation, but that's approximately what it would be the equivalent of. That with a given a population of a billion bacteria, that binding site could evolve in about 20,000 years, which bacteria have been here for 3.7 billion years. That's a blink of an eye.
Yes.
Right. Now, not only did the conclusion reach the opposite, but under cross-examination, as you alluded to, Eric Rothschild did an absolutely brilliant job of essentially making Behe admit that they had rigged the experiment to make it as unlikely as possible that such a site would evolve. And they did this by rigging the parameters to make it very different from real-world conditions. And they did this in several ways. First, by allowing only point mutations to occur.
Right.
Now, point mutations... are very important as a source of variation, but there are lots of other sources, aren't there?
Yes. Now, a point mutation, for the benefit of your listeners, is, remember how I said there are three DNA letters, three DNA bases, required to specify an amino acid. A point mutation is a spontaneous change in one of those, and it occurs at a single point, which is why we call it a point mutation. And these happen every generation in a frequency of about 1 in 1,000,000 or perhaps 1 in 10 million bases, depending upon species. But that was the only way in their simulation that they allowed things to vary. And in the real world, what happens is pieces of DNA are swapped back and forth. There are sexual processes in bacteria that slip code back and forth that transpose them around. There's a process called genetic recombination. And they specifically ruled all of these out of their experiments. In other words, they tried to make it as difficult as possible for their simulated evolution to do anything.
Right. Now, the second way that they rigged this experiment was by using a population size of only 10 to the 8th organisms, or,
right,
like you said, about 100 million organisms.
Now, to the average layperson, 100 million, boy, that sounds like a lot. But, and I have to say, since I wasn't in the courtroom that day, I can't remember if Eric brought this up or not, but in preparing to cross-examine Dr. Behe, I sent Eric a copy of a paper in Science magazine that had estimated the number of bacteria in 1 cubic meter, roughly 1 cubic yard of soil. And it turned out to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the 18th. So what that meant is that in a cubic meter of soil, are there 10 to the 8th, 100 million bacteria? The answer is there are, but there's 100 million, million times 100 million bacteria in just 1 yard of soil.
Right. We don't even have a word for 10 followed by 18 zeros, I don't think.
No, we don't.
So there's the second way, is they used a population size that was far too small. Now, the third way that they rigged this experiment was by setting a parameter that said that none of the mutations in the intermediate steps could be selectable. That is, they could confer no survival advantage whatsoever. But again, in the real world, a given mutation might very well help a protein bind just a little bit better than it did before, can't it?
Yes, absolutely. And this is the way in which intelligent design argues, which is they will take a system that is working now, whether it is the bacterial flagellum or the proteins that clot our blood or their little protein binding site, and they will assume, quite at variance with the facts, they will assume that every part of that system has to be assembled before it has any selective advantage, in other words, before it's useful to the organism. And the reality of protein evolution is that it's not an all-or-none thing. You can produce binding sites that stick a little bit, binding sites that stick pretty well, and binding sites that hold proteins together very, very tightly. So they, again, were completely unrealistic in this assumption that you had to assemble everything before you had any selective advantage.
So let's put all this together, and here's what I think this says. What that study really shows is that if you assume a population of bacteria on the entire Earth that is multiple orders of magnitude less than the number of bacteria in a single cubic meter of soil, and if you assume that it undergoes only point mutations, and if you rule out recombination, transposition, insertion deletion, frame shift mutations, and all of the other documented sources of mutation and genetic variation, and if you assume that none of the intermediate steps would serve any function that might help them be preserved, then it would take 20,000 years, or approximately 1/195,000th of the time bacteria have been on the Earth, for this supposedly irreducibly complex trait to evolve. The very definition of an irreducible complex system, according to Behe, to develop and then be fixed in a population. Doesn't this study disprove irreducible complexity?
Well, I think it does, and actually there's an even, I think, better way to put the conclusion that you just did, and that is if you take realistic numbers of bacteria, then you can do a calculation, and I did this using Behe's own numbers, showing that in a cubic meter of soil, a protein binding site of the sort that they demand would evolve once every 30 minutes.
Wow.
And would keep evolving. So that's the extent to which they had stacked the deck to try to prove their conclusion. And frankly, when you have to stack the deck that much, it shows that your argument simply doesn't hold scientific water.
Well, even worse, when you go to the trouble of stacking the deck that much and you still don't reach the conclusion that you want, right?
It's one thing to play with marked cards. It's another thing to play with marked cards and lose.
Right. Now, during the Dover trial, Dr. Behe pulled out a phrase that was new to me, one that I don't remember seeing in his previous writings. He claimed that we know a system is designed if that system shows a, quote, purposeful arrangement of parts. And he said that we would know when a given arrangement of parts was purposeful if those parts are, quote, ordered to perform some function. But in fact, Dr. Behe accepts that many systems that contain multiple parts that are ordered to perform a function did evolve. For example, he's admitted that the antifreeze proteins in Arctic fish evolved on their own without any intelligent designer having to intervene.
Correct.
Explain to our audience how such proteins evolved and why this should be a perfect example of the evolution of an irreducibly complex system.
Well, first of all, his criterion about a purposeful arrangement of parts, how do you know if arrangement of parts is purposeful? In other words, he's basically saying, I'll know it when I see it. I don't know of a scientific test for purposeful. So, you know, that's really the first point on this. The Arctic antifreeze proteins are extraordinary. There are, despite the fact that the Arctic and the Antarctic oceans are several degrees below freezing. In other words, the temperature of the oceans are well below 0 degrees Celsius. And if your listeners will wonder, wait a minute, doesn't water freeze at that level? The answer is no, because there's a lot of salt in it, and that depresses the freezing point. Nonetheless, if you or I, or for that matter, a tropical fish, were dropped into the Antarctic Ocean, our blood would freeze solid in a matter of a few minutes. But this doesn't happen to the fish that live down there. Well, the answer is why not? Well, the reason for that is they make a kind of protein that sort of serves the same function that ethylene glycol does in the antifreeze in your car. It depresses the freezing point in the bloodstream. And this enables their blood to remain liquid well below 0 degrees Celsius and keeps them alive. Now, the interesting thing about this protein is in the last 10 years or so, molecular biologists have tried to take a look at it, see where it came from. And it turns out that it is a modified version of a digestive enzyme, a protease, a protein-cutting enzyme, that first of all was mistargeted to the bloodstream, and then secondly had accumulated a whole series of mutations. And these mutations turn out to increase the binding affinity for water of the protein. Why is that important? The way in which you depress the freezing point, in other words, the way in which antifreeze works, is in fact by binding water. So we had a perfectly good explanation in pure evolutionary terms for the mistargeting of this protein to the blood and the accumulation of mutations that made it a more effective antifreeze protein. And then here's the really cool part about all this. By comparing the sequence of this protein to fish related to this one, which still live in warm waters, it was possible to estimate how many years, roughly, it took for the proteins that we see today in Antarctic and Arctic fishes to evolve. And the answer turned out to be for Antarctic fishes about 5 or 6 million years. Why is that important? It's important because geologists will tell you that it was about 5 or 6 million years ago that the continent of Antarctica, which used to be a warm weather continent, there's a lot of fossils in Antarctica actually, that's when the climate changed in Antarctica and it dropped to the temperature it is today. So you have this wonderful convergence of a story from biochemistry, molecular biology, and ultimately from geology and Earth history.
And what's important here is that Behe has admitted, he accepts that this system evolved on its own, didn't need any designer to intervene. And yet this is a system that requires multiple mutations, multiple parts working together to all make it work.
Yeah, I mean, he can hardly do otherwise than admit that this must have evolved because the evidence is ultimately so clear-cut. I should point out, however, that lots of other people in the intelligent design movement will still not admit that this protein, which gave these fish a new capability after all, they will still not admit that this protein is the product of evolution. And they'll say, you haven't shown that this could happen in the laboratory, you haven't reproduced the steps, you don't know every single mutation on the way there.
Here's the question that I've always wanted to ask Behe. If you now accept that the various antifreeze protein systems evolved without the intervention of a designer because we now have well-documented and reasoned explanations for how they developed, Couldn't you have made the very same argument you make about the flagellum or the blood clotting cascade before we had those well-documented explanations that you now accept? And if that's the case, as it clearly is, and the inference to a designer from a lack of evolutionary explanation turned out to be false in that case, why shouldn't we think it's false in this case? Isn't that a classic God of the Gaps argument? Isn't this a science stopper?
Well, first of all, it is a God of the Gaps argument, and it is a science stopper. I thought one of the best lines of the trial was given by Kevin Padian when he was on the witness stand. He's a paleontologist from the University of California, Berkeley. And at the end of the trial, he was asked by one of our attorneys, what's your real objection to teaching intelligent design in the schools? And his answer was, it makes kids stupid. And what he meant by that is it basically tells them, you know, if you're confronted by an example, like the antifreeze proteins in this fish, it tells you, well, that's the way they were designed. Stop thinking. Stop investigating. And that would be a terrible message to send young science students. But I do have to tell you, what Behe would say, if you asked him the question that you just wondered about, is he would say, that's the subject of my new book. He has a book that came out last year, a year before actually, called The Edge of Evolution. And what he would argue is that evolution can change things up to a point, up to a level of complexity. That's what he calls the edge. But beyond that, evolution just can't go. And beyond that, you need intelligent design. So he would probably say, you know, you're right, Ed, but the antifreeze protein is just right at the edge. That's at the limit of what natural processes can achieve. And I've detected that, and I've made arguments as to why that's the edge. Anything beyond that requires the intervention of my designer. So he'd find a way out of it. But for any of your listeners who are interested, that book by Behe, The Edge of Evolution, had the misfortune to be reviewed in Science magazine by the distinguished evolutionary biologist from Wisconsin, Sean Carroll. It had the misfortune to be reviewed in Nature by me. And it had the very great misfortune to be reviewed in the New York Times, in the New York Review of Books, by Richard Dawkins. And I think, needless to say, all three of us took his book apart, dismembered it on scientific grounds, and all of us gave it very, very bad reviews.
Well, and it's not a coincidence that what he thinks is just beyond the evolution, and I think this is the point I was trying to make, the things that are just beyond the point, the edge of evolution, that, you know, the power of evolution to create, are, of course, those systems for which we haven't worked out a completely detailed explanation for yet.
Yeah, in a way, he's saying, well, if we haven't figured it out yet, we probably never will.
Right, and that's the science stuff.
That's right. That's a way of saying, hey, we figured out everything we're going to. Let's take a nap. And again, that's just not the way science is done.
I'd like to change subjects a bit, and I'll go to a later part of your book that I found very fascinating. You noticed something that I've also noticed over the last few years, which is how the intelligent design movement has borrowed the rhetoric of relativism from certain factions of the academic left. And you drew some parallels with Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, which is a book that had a big influence on me 20 years ago. Give my listeners some background on what it was, your argument in this regard.
Well, first of all, let's put a little context here for the Alan Bloom book that you talk about. Alan Bloom was a conservative humanities scholar, and a great one, at the University of Chicago. He became distressed in the 60s and early 70s about the state of the humanities in the American Revolution, in the American university, excuse me. And the reason he became distressed was, in effect, the fruits of what happened in the 60s and 70s. In other words, the coming to fruition of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, also the movement of women and minorities into mainstream culture and so forth. Now, he would say he wasn't really depressed about that, but here's what bothered him. The whole idea of multiculturalism at the university, he thought, was leading to a kind of cultural relativism. And as he put it, the worst thing now, this is 30 years ago, but he said the worst thing now that anyone can do within academia is actually to come to a conclusion about anything. Because what everyone is required to do, he said, is have their minds so open, that's why his book was called The Closing of the American Mind, so open that in fact they are closed. And what he meant by that sort of paradoxical statement is that if you're open to everything and you refuse to apply reason to judge things, if you simply say, well, yes, Shakespeare was a great writer, but we really can't judge anyone So maybe Mike Hammer was just as good, or for that matter, maybe those who tell tales among the Australian Aborigines are their Shakespeares, and we have no right to judge one over the other. He said, if you do that, then basically you're denying the critical power of human reason. And the university, if the university is about anything, it's about the ability to expose young minds to ideas and then show them how to use their wits, their intellects, and human reasons to come to informed decisions about things. And he was afraid that wasn't happening anymore at the university because of this argument that all ideas are equal. Now, I read Bloom's book at the beginning of my career as a college professor, and I figured, well, I'm in the sciences, so this doesn't really apply to me. And actually, if you reread Bloom's book today, he'll tell you that this plague of relativism hasn't infected the sciences, he said. And the reason for that is the sciences have this wonderful objective criteria. And, you know, they do experiments and they rule things out, and the humanities don't have the blessing of that. Well, when I started to read the initial things that came out from the intelligent design movement about a decade ago, they kept reminding me of something. And the more that I read of them, the more I realized, you know what? They are trying to do to the sciences what Bloom thought the academic left was trying to do to humanities, which is to say, yes, there is a dominant idea, a dominant paradigm. It's called evolution. But we have a paradigm, too. That paradigm is called intelligent design. It's just as good as yours, and you should act as though both of these ideas are equal, give them equal status, teach them in the school side by side, and let students make up their own minds. And it's remarkable. And every now and then, someone will say, well, wait a minute now. You're saying the strategy that the ID movement is following comes from the academic left, not the right, but the left. How did that happen? And my answer to that, it might be flippant, but I don't think it's inaccurate. The originator of the intelligent design strategy, a strategy that's called the wedge strategy, everyone agrees, was Philip Johnson, a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. Where better to absorb the lingo and the strategy and the approach of the academic left than being a professor at Berkeley? And I think Johnson learned his lessons on how to fight within academia perfectly, and that's the basis of the ID movement.
And I think you're absolutely right about that. One of the strangest parts of the Dover trial to me, and this is it fits perfectly with what you just said, was the testimony of Steve Fuller, who was a philosopher of science, who was an expert witness for the school board. And his argument is a perfect example of what you're talking about. It was basically rhetoric borrowed from the postmodernist left and applied in defense of an idea being advocated by the religious right. He argued that fringe ideas in science are being suppressed by an academic and intellectual elite, and that ID should be put into science classes in order to help the ID movement recruit new adherents who might later help to make it a theory that explains something, which he admitted it does not now do. But, of course, the history of science shows that there are lots of ideas that were initially rejected and even scorned that later became well accepted and dominant. In none of those cases, it was Big Bang cosmology or continental drift with Alfred Wegener. In none of those cases, after that initial rejection, did they start hiring public relations firms, trying to get Congress to pass amendments, try to get school boards to put their ideas into science classrooms. They just got to work and did the hard work of science, right?
That's right. No, I think that's absolutely true. And let me use an example that illustrates exactly what I mean. There is a very highly respected virologist, who's also at Berkeley, by the way, named Peter Duisberg. And Duisberg was in a very small minority of virologists and biochemists who argued that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. Now, I think Duisberg was wrong. Most people in the AIDS field think he was wrong and continues to be wrong. Duisberg argued mightily that AIDS was caused by other things and so forth. So it was very much a fringe view. Nonetheless, he was still able to publish these arguments in journals like Science and Nature, went to academic conferences, tried to convince his colleagues. And you know what else he did? He did research. And he tried very hard to set up experiments that would show that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. Now, most people today would say he failed. And in fact, the very successes of the kinds of antiviral therapy that are prolonging the lives of AIDS patients today are predicated on the notion that HIV really is the cause of AIDS. So we're quite confident that Duisberg was wrong about this. But here's why I respect Duisberg in a way I don't respect intelligent design people. He wasn't running to school boards and state legislatures and curriculum committees saying, because I have this view, you ought to teach it. He was in the laboratory. He was trying to do studies to produce the evidence that would convince the rest of the scientific community. And right or wrong, that's how authentic science is done. But that point seems to have completely missed the intelligent design crowd. As I said before, they'd rather do politics and public relations than roll up their sleeves and do an experiment.
Well, one of the points that you make in your book is that scientists are really the ultimate pragmatists. Give them something that works. Give them something that actually functions as an explanation, and they will eagerly grab a hold of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just to give you an example, I was fortunate enough in my first year of teaching at the university where I am now to have a very bright, inquisitive student in my cell biology class. His name was Craig. Craig went on to grad school. I lost track of him for a few years. And then all of a sudden he resurfaced, and I started reading his papers, and I couldn't believe what he had gotten into. There were some very strange experiments, the first ones which were done in plants, in which investigators added a certain amount of an RNA into a plant or plant cell that should have had an effect. And in fact, what happened was the opposite effect, and it was very, very puzzling. No one knew what to make of it. A lot of people said, well, you know, it's plants, who cares? Or it's petunias, that's the species where it first happened. But other people were puzzled by it. And Craig and a friend of his named Andrew Fire were two of the people who got interested in this. They were able to show that the same thing occurs in animals. They were experimenting with a worm. And then they came up with a testable explanation for how this process worked. Today, we call that explanation RNA interference. And Craig Mello and Andrew Fire in 2007 won the Nobel Prize in medicine or physiology for taking this very weird phenomenon, suddenly proposing a testable explanation and showing that it worked. And what that shows, among other things, is that even explanations that people think, you know, what's the point of this? This is not interesting. If that dog will hunt, as you say, if it works, and that working is something you can demonstrate to the rest of the scientific community, they will jump on your bandwagon immediately because, as you say, scientists are the ultimate pragmatists. And if the ID guys were right, you know, if they really had a legitimate argument, if they did the experiments, produced the results, you know what? I'd be writing ID into the textbooks myself without any prodding from anybody else. But the fact is they just haven't done that.
One more change of subject here, and I want to put this in the context of this battle in the context of politics and religion. One of the things that you point out in your book, and I've been saying this myself for years, is that the validity of a scientific theory has nothing at all to do with whatever political or religious beliefs its adherents might hold. And I think it's important to make the point that you make in the book, that evolution is just a scientific theory, and that scientific theories are not political in nature. You can accept evolution and hold any other political or philosophical idea imaginable. You can accept evolution and be a conservative or a liberal, a socialist or a libertarian, an atheist or a Christian, a Jew or a Hindu, and so forth. The ID movement likes to rant and rave about naturalism, but the point that I keep making, that I see you making in the book, is that evolution is really no more naturalistic than any other theory in science. It's naturalistic in precisely the same sense that every other theory in science, from the Big Bang to the germ theory of disease, is naturalistic. And just like you can accept the germ theory of disease and be a Christian or an atheist, the same is true of evolution, right?
Oh, indeed. And, you know, I've heard people say to me, well, you know, if God did not directly create species, then why should I believe in him? And, you know, my answer is, you know, 2,000 years ago, people thought that God made the tides come in and out. We now know this simply happens because of the combined gravitation of the sun, the moon, and the earth. Does that diminish your religious faith? Of course not. Some people will get down on their knees and pray for rain because they think the Lord can move the weather. Well, maybe he can't. But does that mean meteorologists are a threat to your faith because they predict the weather based on physical means? And the answer is, of course not. If you're a spiritual person, you believe that God is the ultimate author of all things natural. Evolution is a natural process, and therefore that means he's the author of that process as well. If you're not a person of faith, you simply think that nature exists on its own, and you can still study that natural process in exactly the same way. And that's one of the reasons. Occasionally scientists will get involved in arguments about religion. But it's one of the reasons when you actually look at the practice of science, we simply don't pay any attention to the religious beliefs of each other because they just don't matter. If I'm running a gel sequencing a stretch of DNA or collaborating with a scientist somewhere else, it doesn't matter to me if he's an agnostic, an atheist, a Jew, or a Hindu, and it doesn't matter to him that I'm a Roman Catholic. It's irrelevant because science stands on its own. It's the closest thing. Science is the closest thing we have on this planet to a universal culture, and I think that's valuable and that's worth protecting.
I took a lot of heat a couple of years ago for writing an article where I said that there were two different groups of people, you know, who are active in defending evolution. One group is working to defend science education against the attacks of creationists, and the other group is trying to rid the planet of religion. And while I'm a non-believer myself, I am firmly in that first group, and I think that Christians like you who accept evolution and defend it are on my side, because I'm not in a battle to destroy religion. I'm in a battle to prevent creationism from getting into science classrooms. And I think that you and others like you, like Francis Collins, Keith Miller, my friend Howard Van Til, are great allies in this battle. You can get listened to by an audience that will tune me out completely. And has that been your experience?
Well, I think it is for the most part. Although naturally, of course, I get people challenging the sincerity of my religious beliefs, which always makes my daughters laugh. They once saw someone saying an article saying that Ken Miller's not a real Christian, and one of my daughters moaned, saying, "Yeah, that's why he drags us to church every Sunday. That's why he says grace before meal every night, and all that other sort of stuff." But the reality is, and I think you're right about those two groups. I really do, that many of my scientific colleagues think that the problem with intelligent design is that it basically leads to religious faith. And that's the worst thing that could happen. The real problem with intelligent design is not whether it strengthens or weakens the idea of religion. The real problem with intelligent design is it's bad science. And I think anyone who prizes scientific reason ought to be against it, regardless of their religious point of view. And you're absolutely right. If we start demanding a litmus test of people in the scientific community, that you must be a skeptic or you must be an agnostic to be a legitimate scientist, first of all, we're going to do terrible disservice to the scientific community. We're going to lose public support. And you know what else we're going to do? We're going to fly in the face of history. And what do I mean by that? Gregor Mendel, the founder of the modern science of genetics, was a Catholic priest. Isaac Newton was a faithful Christian. George Lemaître, the physicist who first worked out the mathematics of the Big Bang, was a priest. So it turns out the notion that one cannot do legitimate, reasoned, important, rational science if you're a person of faith is simple nonsense, and the history of science proves that. And I think ultimately we have to realize, yes, there are religious questions that divide all of us, but the one thing that is the pearl of great price that we all have to stand for is scientific reason. And I think it's important to this country's future.
We've got about 1 minute left. Isn't it, so give me a brief answer to this, isn't it really important, therefore, to separate scientific theories from any philosophical inferences we might draw from them?
Well, I think you certainly have to separate science from the philosophical inferences we draw, as you say. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't make the philosophical inferences. Science is important in part because it changes our own view of the world around us. It enriches what we understand about nature. And I think it's only human, once that view becomes more and more enriched by scientific discovery, to sit back and say, now, what does this mean? How should we order our lives? What does this mean about whether or not there's a God? So I think science can drive that, but we ought not to pretend that our philosophical thoughts, even if they're informed by science, are scientific themselves.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. I think it's very, very important to make a separation there. And those speculations are very important and they're very interesting, but they're not part of science itself.
Indeed. That doesn't mean that those questions are not important and not worth answering. It simply means it's often beyond the purview of science to be able to answer them.
Right. Well, Ken Miller, thank you very much for being here and taking your time, and we look forward to maybe talking to you again at a later date.
Ed, it was a great pleasure. Happy to talk with you anytime.
All right. I want to thank Ken Miller and Ion Hersey Ali for being with us this week. A couple of great interviews that I hope you found informative. You have been listening to Declaring Independence on Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM. Please visit our website, www.declaringindependenceradio.com, and meet us back here at the same time next week.
Declaring Independence is a production of WPRR Reality Radio. Ed Brayton is a fellow of the Center for Independent Media, but views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Center for Independent Media or its contributors. Technical assistance provided by Jeremy Behan and David Fletcher. To share this program with a friend or catch up on previous episodes, check out the Declaring Independence podcast, available at publicrealityradio.org.